This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We are opposing. We have no choice. Workers, I think, they must unite. They must fight against this onslaught. One of the targets that the CW must face, amongst others, is the government itself. Even if we were to have a night vigil at Luthuli House, let it be. Because workers have to defend themselves and defend the jobs that are there and also the economy of the country.
That's Aubrey Shabalala, General Secretary of the Communications Workers Union in South Africa, on planned layoffs as the economy continues to suffer. Details coming up also. We'll have a discussion on the latest from Sudan, and we'll look into a joint statement released by the U.S. Treasury regarding the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, last Tuesday, members of the Operations Authority of the Intelligence Service took control of the service's headquarters buildings around the capital Khartoum, firing bullets in the air and blocking off streets. Security personnel made up of rapid support forces and the Sudanese army intervened and took control of the agency's buildings. To enlighten us on the matter, we have in studio Kuskondi Abdul Shafi, Regional Advisor Sudan at Freedom House. He's an award-winning human rights activist with over 10 years of experience working on peace, human rights, and democracy in Sudan and East Africa. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, sir.
Well, welcome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And it's an honor to be here as your guest.
Mr. Abdul Shafi, it must have been a very terrifying day in Khartoum last Tuesday when this incident took place. Were the perpetrators Bashir loyalists, and where do things stand now?
Mostly it was a very terrible morning, night, full day of armed ammunition shooting very heavily in residential areas inside Khartoum, but also in few places outside Khartoum, like a larger city called Medeni in the central Sudan, and the capital city of the north, Kordofan, Al-Obaid. And it is it's known that this is kind of an organized strike from the operation Department of Operation ATNA of the National Intelligence and Security Service. And it was indeed a terrifying morning, having this heavy shooting continued for very long hours, and nobody knows what's going on in, and military vehicles going in to surround, to try to control this, the situation inside. So, yes, it was a terrifying.
So what do you do with these security forces? Do you absorb them in the army or do you dismiss them?
So this is one of the very strong and critical questions for Sudan's transitional security sector reform. Particularly the Department of Operation and other militia that indirectly might have been part of this, which is called Popular Defense Force, are the party military, but these are party military that are tasked to protect the regime and President Bashir personally. So these forces were under direct command of the president. With removal of the president in power, they remain useless because they don't know now what is their role within this current balance and equation in the transition. So what happens was that they have been, they are spoiled because they receive a lot of money. They are outlawed. They make laws and constitutional amendments that protect these forces from being questioned by any authority in the country. So they also control the greater sector of economy in the country. Now, within this equation, they left out. They have been given an option to either join the military forces or join the rapid support force or remain as general intelligence, which is mainly the role of getting information, analyzing, and working on the cases. But these forces are highly trained military operations, and their training was as an objective to replace the regular armed forces. So they are leading high military operation, and they think they deem useless within the intelligence, with the current role of the intelligence security. So that's why they are trying to show that we are here, and if you don't give us what we want, we can make troubles.
So what do you see as we move forward towards election and beyond for Sudan?
The trajectory of the current transitional Sudan depends heavily on very meticulously and carefully understands the dynamics within the security sector. And the problem is that the security sector within the whole these years is being tribalized, ethnically ideologized within the party, but also privatized. They're more affiliated to the leaders and their groups than affiliated to the state. That is why it is very difficult to see the people don't trust the everything in the security sector that exists, including the senior Sudan Armed Forces. So I think understanding these complexities and putting this in the balance that there is also other armed groups that are armed oppositions that are still getting in to add more complexity within this, I think it is very important to put very clear way for the transitional government, particularly the security sector, the civilian sector, because they don't have, according to the constitutional document that has been signed, they don't have any authority or power to influence the security sector reform or decision in the security sector, and that is something that is very critical.
And lastly, shortly, what does the situation stand with sanctions against Sudan?
The sanctions, the U.S. Promised to lift the Sudan. So the existing sanctions have been lifted since 2017, but it's still like Sudan still exists in the countries sponsoring terrorists so far, and that is being a bit kind of a challenge for the transitional government.
Yes.
However, with the very heavy diplomatic movement, U.S. is being very strongly and actively involved in this process, and I think in the process that's going, will be handed out.
Kuskondi Abdul Shafi, Regional Advisor, Sudan at Freedom House. Thank you for your input, sir.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Speaking of Sudan, the country's foreign minister and a delegation were invited by U.S. President Donald Trump at the White House, along with Ethiopian and Egyptian foreign and water resources ministers, to discuss the contentious issue surrounding the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. To talk about the matter, we have in studio my colleague, VOA Salem Salamon. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Salem, what is Sudan's position so far?
So Sudan, as you heard, has been neutral so far. The country is going through internal transition. But the tributaries of the Nile meet at Khartoum in Sudan. And Khartoum has nearly 2 million residents that relies on the Nile for irrigation. So it's a serious matter for the country.
So what is the latest and what was decided or what did they agree on?
So the three nations agreed following a meeting in Washington at the behest of, observers, the World Bank, and also Secretary Treasury Mnuchin. They agreed on several points, and not clear deal so far, but a few details have been emerging. The dam to be filled during wet season because of Egypt's concern has been the
August.
Dropping down of it, yes. And also, severe drought has been a concern for Egypt during initial filling testing. So they're hoping for mitigation of some sort whenever that is a possibility, and also prolonged dry years and drought. Just to give you a little bit of background, Ethiopia considers this as a sovereignty issue. The Nile emanates from Ethiopia, and it's been critical that Ethiopia stance has been no interference from foreign players, and they wanted a tripartite agreement with Egypt, Sudan, and the key players on this issue. It started building the dam in 2011 without what the Egyptians consider not consulting them. It was at the height of this Arab Spring when there were protests in Egypt, but they refused to be bound by a 1929 treaty that favors Egypt and gives autonomy to Egypt. And so Ethiopia felt that it's because it emanates there that they have to move forward with this. What they're hoping to get out of the completion of this dam is Ethiopia, over 60% of its population has electricity power outage issues. And so they want what's expected is 6,000 megawatts of electricity at the completion of this. And so they hope not only alleviating problems of electricity in Ethiopia, but they hope to export it to South Sudan, Sudan, Kenya, Djibouti, and even Eritrea, neighboring Eritrea. And so they have big plans for this, but Egypt is very concerned and has been wanting to have a longer period of not curbing the flow of the Nile. And they've suggested between 10 to 21 years of the building of the dam. And we are hearing that it's been reported 80% of the dam has already been completed. And so key things that are coming out are kind of vague, but at least all of the technical issues are being discussed with scientists and doctors that study this. And also at a political level, the foreign ministers are sitting to discuss what could be the solution moving forward.
So have they set a date? Will they be able to resolve this ongoing issue?
Well, the final deal is expected to be signed on 28th and 29th January, so maybe at the end of this month. But this is the meetings have been going on for quite a while. Actually, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed was traveling to South Africa on a working visit, and he gave a press briefing where he mentioned the dam issue, and he said, maybe the incoming chair of the African Union, President Cyril Ramaphosa, might be able to solve. And he said, as our brother, as our neighboring, as our friendly country, maybe they could sit and negotiate. And Ramaphosa also said, the Nile is very important for Egypt and Ethiopia and the countries. There must be a way to resolve this. So they showed their willingness to at least facilitate some sort of conversation between the two countries.
VOA Salem Salomon, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
The South African economy has started the year on a bad note, with several companies announcing they intend to retrench thousands of workers in the coming months. State-owned enterprises also continue to fail because of fears of corruption and a dwindling economy. Experts warn it could get worse, considering that the power utility Eskom has resumed implementing planned power blackouts. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
2020, also referred to as 2020 by many people in South Africa, is having a rocky start for many. The country's telecoms company, Telkom South Africa, has announced its intention to cut 3,000 jobs. Retail giant Massmart Holdings South Africa says it plans to close up to 34 stores, leaving 1,440 employees jobless. The workers' unions are angry. Obri Shabalala is the General Secretary of the Communications Workers Union, CWU.
We are opposing. We have no choice. Workers, I think, they must unite. They must fight against this onslaught. One of the targets that the CWU must face, amongst others, is the government itself. Even if we are to have a night vigil at Luthuli House, let it be. Because workers have to defend themselves and defend the jobs that are there and also the economy of the country.
State-owned enterprises have not been spared. At least two have been put under administration, with their affairs now run by trained business rescuers. The South African Airways has announced it could suspend some flights and delay salary payments if it does not get close to $140 million capital injection from the government. Economist Duma Qubule cautions things could get even worse.
IMF forecast, they say we'll grow by 1%. So that means that we'll have another year, the sixth year of declining GDP per capita. In fact, what the IMF has also forecast is that we're going to have 7 and 8 years of declining GDP per capita. They cannot see any economic growth over the next 3 years that is in excess of the population growth rate.
And President Cyril Ramaphosa agrees, though optimistic that the economic challenges will be overcome.
Our economy is not growing, and unemployment is on the rise, and businesses are struggling. Demand is low, and a number of businesses are shedding jobs. And investor confidence is also on the decline. It keeps leveling out, but it has been declining for quite a while.
Busisiwe Mavuso, president of the Business Leadership South Africa, wants concrete actions from the president.
I think time has come that the president stops acknowledging the problems that we have in the country, but starts taking intentional and deliberate actions towards some of the structural reforms that we need as a country. We're going to have to move at a speed of lightning to ensure that we avoid the looming credit downgrade by Moody's.
Banking and mining are also the sectors where talks of retrenchments have already caused anxiety amongst thousands of families. South Africa's current unemployment rate, which is the number of employable people who have no jobs, is standing at 29.1%. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. People are again fleeing northwest and southwest Cameroon as fresh clashes intensify between the military and separatist fighting to create an English-speaking state. The government is trying to subdue the fighters ahead of council and parliamentary elections scheduled for February 9th. Mokidwe Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé that the fighting is casting doubt over whether the elections can take place as voters, candidates, and election officials escape to safer locations.
René Fonzeyouf, a 32-year-old carpenter and candidate for the local council elections, has just arrived in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, with his wife, three children, his mother and father. He says they escaped from the northwestern village of Kikai after a wave of fighting between the military and separatists fighting to secede from Cameroon and form a state they call Ambazonia.
You get up sometimes and you just notice dead bodies. You don't know whether they have been killed by the Ambazonia fighters or the military. We have been threatened by the Ambazonians. Some people are being kidnapped. When you hear the shooting, you have to run for safety. When you return home, the house is burned. You don't actually know who is behind the burning of the houses.
Fonzeyouf and his family initially fled the separatist conflict to Yaoundé in January 2018 and decided to return to Kikai in December. He said there was relative peace when they returned, but that as the February elections draw near, violence is intensifying. The separatists have vowed the elections will not take place. Cameroon's military last week deployed 1,000 troops to the English-speaking regions and said it had intensified attacks on separatist strongholds such as Kikai, other northwestern villages like Wainama, Ndu, Ngarum, Bali, and the southwestern villages of Mamfe and Lebialem. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of the English-speaking regions, says the presence of the troops should assure civilians of their safety.
They are already surrendered by the forces of law and order. So the candidate should come. The population is collaborating with the state. So let those leaders come back.
Bilai said it was difficult to say how many returnees were fleeing since they were going to different French-speaking towns and safer localities in the English-speaking regions. But the Ministry of Transport says it has recorded hundreds of people fleeing the fighting within the past 5 days. Eno Abrams Egwe, head of the Cameroon's elections management body ELECAM, says some of his field staff have fled.
Election, Cameroon va mettre tous les moyens pour corriger une élection paisible.
He says Cameroonians should view elections as a factor that unites rather than divides them, and that the elections management body ELECAM will make sure its staff is deployed all over Cameroon for the elections to be successful, but that as every other Cameroonian in the English-speaking regions, they also need military protection. The fleeing civilians and candidates say if current trends continue, the elections will not take place in the English-speaking regions. But Paul Atanganji, Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, says in spite of the clashes, elections must take place as planned.
Any form of challenge will not be tolerated. As advocated on several occasions by His Excellency Paul Biya, the democratic process in our country is irreversible.
Separatists have been fighting since 2017 to separate English-speaking North West and South West Cameroon from the rest of the country and its French-speaking majority. More than 3,000 lives have been lost in the conflict, according to the UN. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says community mistrust was the cause of an attack on Red Cross volunteers in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo this week. The attack took place during a burial service for an Ebola victim in Ituri province. Lisa Schlein reports from the Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
Two of the 18 Red Cross volunteers performing a burial service of a suspected Ebola victim Monday were seriously injured. They are recovering in a hospital where they are receiving medical and psychological care. The director of health and care at the Red Cross Federation, Emmanuel Capobianco, tells VOA the attack was fueled by mistrust and suspicion among some members of the community.
And the attack came from within the community, and there was a moment of panic during the burial that made the mob react and go after the team of volunteers that were performing the burial. Some of them were attacked with machetes.
The World Health Organization reports that 3,382 cases of Ebola, including 2,232 deaths, have occurred in Congo's North Kivu and Ituri provinces since the start of the outbreak in August 2018. The epidemic is unfolding in an area affected by a two-decades-long conflict that has claimed countless lives. Capobianco says this unstable, dangerous situation has raised fear and hostility in communities toward responders.
The episode was regrettable, and I think the expression of the frustration in the communities that is seeing this Ebola outbreak continuing month after month, and you know this is a year and a half now, and that's a way that the frustration and the fear is manifesting.
Capobianco says the attack is a sign that the Red Cross needs to do more to build community trust and acceptance. He says the hundreds of volunteers involved in Ebola operations come from the communities in which they work. He says this is one of their strengths. After the volunteers recover from the shock of the attack, he says they will go back into the communities. The Red Cross official says they will talk and listen to what they have to say while continuing to involve them in the Ebola response. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.